The following podcast is an exclusive presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
Hi, this is Brian Keene. I'm an international best-selling, award-winning horror novelist.
No comment!
I know where the bodies are buried, and now I'm telling you their location every week on The Horror Show.
Brian, no comment! Don't you understand?
We discuss the latest news in horror novels, movies, comics, and games, and interview the biggest names in the business.
This interview is over! No comment!
Thursday nights at 7 p.m. only on
Project Entertainment Network.
Monster Attack is coming right up after this word from our sponsor, Subculture Corsets and Clothing.
Hey, Creepy McCreep persons. Looking for something out of the box to wear? Then you better visit subculturecorsets.com. Subculture Corsets and Clothing carries all of the unusual clothing and accessory brands for the steampunk, gothic, apocalypse, rockabilly, and pimp scenes. Or perhaps you're into Victorian goth. Whatever you freaks are into, most likely Subculture Corsets and Clothing will have something for you. Now, if you're a curvy lady, Subculture offers sizes 4 through 4X and men's clothing as well, so no excuses. Visit subculturecorsets.com now for that new exciting piece, or visit their store at the Avenue Mall in Jacksonville, Florida, located a half a mile off I-95. When checking out on Subculture's website, use the discount code MONSTERATTACK for 10% off your entire order. That's subculturecorsets.com. Discount code MONSTERATTACK. Check them out now.
This is full-scale war against the terrible enemy. Modern man has never fought.
Tell them, for you do not realize you are in a game of stellar invasions. You are already outside the atmosphere of your own planet.
Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack!
Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of Monster Attack. You know, for the last couple of weeks, we've been doing shows on some of the classic actors and actresses that have appeared in a lot of those horror movies that we saw as kids growing up. And today's going to be no different because I'm going to be talking about a fellow who was around a long, long time in some of these movies. In fact, I'm trying to think probably it seemed like every other monster movie or science fiction movie that I saw in the old Monster Movie Matinee show had this fellow in one of the movies. And as a kid, when I saw this guy in a movie, I always knew I was going to probably have a good time with it. They weren't the best movies in the world, and a lot of them were very low budget, like the one we're going to talk about today. But there was just something about this guy that was very, very reassuring. So let me quit teasing you a little bit, and let's talk about this movie and who I'm talking about. The actor I'm referring to is Morris Ancrum, and it was a long, long time before I really made the connection between his name and who he was. I just knew who he was as a kid, and then finally I went and looked him up years later. Morris Ancrum appeared in all kinds of films. In fact, we've mentioned a few of his films already. I guess the last one maybe that we talked about Morrison was The Giant Claw. He always played, I want to say, sort of a grandfatherly type guy. He was usually a scientist or a craggy old general of some sort, but he was always a very likable character and very, very steady. Now, you know, there may be people out there that don't consider his performances Academy Award winning, but they were very durable, they were very believable, and he was just, he was the same character virtually in every movie he did, which isn't a bad thing. It was a very stabilizing influence. And in the movie we're talking about today, he's not going to be a military guy, but he's going to be a scientist. He's an archaeologist in this movie. And the movie we're going to be talking about today comes to us from 1958, and it's called Giant from the Unknown. Interesting little film. It was one that I enjoyed watching as a kid. It wasn't in the playlist a lot on Monster Movie Matinee, but it would show up now and then. And for those of you listening to this podcast, when I describe the story of this movie, which is basically about a Spanish conquistador who has been dead for 500 years, and he's sort of an evil conquistador, and he comes back to life and terrorizes this small this small town that's in the mountains of California. Now, media people are jumping to mind and going, wait a minute, Morris Ancrum is not in that movie. That's the one with William Reynolds. And no, it's very easy to confuse Giant from the Unknown with a movie that also came out in 1958 called The Thing That Couldn't Die, which was about an evil conquistador who was looking for gold in California and whose head ended up floating around and possessing people and getting into all that. Actually, we will probably review that movie in a few weeks or so down the road because they're very, very similar, and they were released within 2 months of one another. This one came out first in March of 1958, and then later on in June of 1958 came the second conquistador, the evil conquistador movie, The Thing That Couldn't Die. So we will get to that later, but it is very easy to confuse these two. Giant from the Unknown deals with a guy who was considered a giant. And that giant, appropriately enough, is played by an actor known as Buddy Bear. Now, that name may seem familiar, Bear, B-A-E-R, because he is the brother of Max Bear. And Max Bear was a heavyweight fighter who was very, very well known in the 30s and the 40s. And Max Bear's son was a very popular actor by the name of Max Bear Jr., who played Jethro in the Beverly Hillbillies. So Buddy Bear is Jethro's uncle in this film. And Buddy Bear was in a lot of films. He was 6'7" tall, so he was a very, very tall actor. And he would appear with guys like James Arness and some of the other very, very tall actors in Hollywood as a bad guy. He always seemed to play bad guys and sort of ominous type figures. And he's very well suited for this role. Now, remember, in 1958, a lot of the actors on screen are fairly short. I mean, I'm only 5'6", and that was sort of the average height for a lot of actors in a lot of these movies. So you put a 5'6" guy against a guy who's 6'7", and especially a guy who is built like a big football player type, and now you can see how you could very believably create a giant in a movie. And Bear does a great job on this. He doesn't have to say much, but he acts a lot with his eyes and with his gestures. And the one plus about this film and Bear's performance is this. He doesn't overact, and I credit that some to his performance and also to the director, who doesn't go in for heavy histrionics. Now, it's a very small-budgeted film. It was only shot for $54,000. Some of it was shot up into the hills of California, and for those of you that love these films, you're going to recognize some of the areas. Not quite as recognizable as maybe Bronson Canyons or whatever, but definitely, clearly the mountains of North California. And one of the drawbacks to shooting a film for such a small amount of money is it is sort of noticeable when they're on location and then when they put this on a set. And the set that they shot this on was the set that belonged to the company that shot this film, a company called Screencraft Enterprises. Now, they didn't make a whole lot of movies, and they only shot about 4 or 5 films that were notable in that studio. But the one that some of you may remember, and it's on my list to review down the road here, She Demons, was the other film that Screencraft Enterprises actually produced. There was a couple of other films like Missile to the Moon and a couple of others that were produced in that, or were shot, I should say, in that studio. So it was sort of known for, you know, for low budget, either sci-fis or horror films for about 10 to 15 years. So let's get on to our cast. A lot of familiar faces in this film, and one in particular, Ed Kemmer. And you might remember Ed Kemmer. We talked about Ed when we were talking about Earth versus the Spider. Ed was also the star in that one, playing a high school kid, although he looked like a 30-year-old high school kid. Still sort of the same age here, because this is just a few years removed from that movie. Ed Kemmer was known for playing in Space Patrol. He was one of the cast members of Space Patrol. Very, very popular television show from the late 40s, early 50s. And a lot of kids grew up with that. Now, I've got to confess, that was just a little before my time, but there's still some old copies of what they call the Vitascopes floating around of Space Patrol. And they're very, very hard to find, but sort of fun to watch. I mean, we're talking television sci-fi from the mid to late 50s. And, you know, they were a lot of fun. They were right up there with the old Flash Gordon serials and things like that. And we loved them. So Ed Kemmer, Space Patrol, and Earth versus the Spider. He is joined by our romantic female lead in this film, Sally Frazier, another name that has come up in some of the podcasts that we have talked about. In fact, Sally has appeared in two of the films that we've reviewed on this podcast. She was also one of the high school students in Earth versus the Spider. And she was also in, I think it was probably the second Roger Corman film that we reviewed, It Conquered the World. A very, very pretty young gal, very nice voice. I always remembered Sally Frazier for a film that we haven't done on this show yet, but I promise you we will talk about very, very soon. War of the Colossal Beast. I know there's some people out there going, oh yeah, I remember that, because that was the sequel to The Amazing Colossal Man, which still, both of those films are right up there on the top of my list of some of the most enjoyable monster movies that I grew up with. And she goes down to Mexico to try to find him in the sequel to The Amazing Colossal Man. And again, she's another one of those pretty young gals. I got to confess, folks, here we go. You know, I absolutely had a crush on her as a kid. She was like the all-American girl that you always had a crush on growing up. And she also plays the daughter of Morris Ankrum's character. He plays Dr. Cleveland, an archaeologist. Now, Ed Kemmer, in this particular film, plays a geologist. So we've got two scientists at play in this particular movie. And I want to mention one other character in this movie, and I get a real kick out of it every time I see this movie, because you have a brother and a sister character in this film. And one is Anne Brown, who is the sister, and Charlie Brown, who is the brother. Now, this is before the Peanuts comic strip became popular. So, you know, now when I hear the name Charlie Brown, and there's so many lines in there you can have so much fun with. when they're saying, where's Charlie Brown? What's happened to Charlie Brown and all that? It's like, yeah, he's probably going kicking a football or something like that. But this is before anyone even knew who the character of Charlie Brown was. Charlie and Anne Brown, they're the characters in this film. They live in this small town. They're probably just out of high school, maybe early 20s at most. And it is established in the film that their parents died not too long ago, but their parents died tragically, and they're just sort of, you know, raising themselves as a sense in their early adulthood. Now, Jolene Brand, who plays Anne Brown, it is of interest because she's been married for many, many years to George Schlatter. And if that name doesn't ring a bell, then if you're a fan of Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In', now you can make the connection. George Schlatter was the producer for Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In', a very successful a television producer for other shows as well for many years. And he and Jolene Brand had been married. Oh, my goodness. I think they were married back in the late 50s or early 60s. So, you know, they're a 50-year couple. They're still married, and have two children who are also performers in the industry. So I got a kick out of that. I said, wow, she's married to the Laugh-In' guy. It's funny. I guess she was sort of retired by the time that Laugh-In' got popular, because her last movie, the last job she had as an actress, was in 1964. And one has to assume that she went ahead and retired from the business to become a mom, a full-time mom with her two kids, which is, I always find that very admirable. But she was very, very popular in this time period, in the 50s and the very, very early 60s. So let's get into the story here a little bit as we talk about the giant from the unknown. Now, we kick things off. It's established very, very quickly that there are some very strange things going on in this town, as an old man that was found just horribly, horribly murdered in the beginning of this film. He has been not just killed, but he's been crushed and torn apart. And there's no, you know, no animal or human being capable of doing this. But it's surmised by the old sheriff. Well, he's not that old. But I mean, the sheriff played by Bob Steele, who's a guy that's been in this business forever, it seems like. I mean, he was in a ton of Westerns. He was a child actor. He is one of those. How do I describe it? He's sort of stiff. He's got a just a no-nonsense type delivery. I won't say like John Wayne, because John Wayne went on to some pretty big things. But Bob Steele is just that kind of guy. He's like the sheriff that we saw in Giant Gila Monster and also in Earth versus the Spider and that sort of thing. And it just fits with all of these guys that we grew up watching when we saw these horror films on Monster Movie Matinee and Shock Theater and things. Now, Sheriff Parker lets us know that this is a horrific murder. Nothing like this has ever happened. And then we also hear the in this discussion with the other farmers, they're talking about livestock are killed and slaughtered and all kinds of weird things going on in this town. So they establish very quickly something strange is happening in this area. Now, we've got our Ed Kemmer's character. He plays the geologist, and his name is Wayne Brooks. He's been up in the mountains for 3 days, and that's when this old guy gets murdered, and so he becomes a likely suspect in the sheriff's mind. And there's an interesting little dynamic in here, and I really pay kudos to our director here, Richard Kuna, who is very good at getting into the mindset of a small town that's sort of isolated up in the mountains, and you can sort of get an idea of the sociology of that. You've got this Wayne Brooks character, you know, and he's a young guy, and he's, you know, he's a scientist, you know, and he's not like the people in the town, and they don't like him. A lot of people just don't like him. They don't trust him because he's an outsider. He's probably from the city and that sort of thing, you know, and not too much unlike what some very, very small towns are like today. And Kuna really, really gets into the heart of this. Brooks comes down from the mountain. He's been looking for rocks up there. And we find out that he had a run-in with the old man when he was on his property and got chased off and apparently run off with a shotgun from the property. And I should mention, just to make it easier, Old Man Banks, that's who I'm referring to, a name based on Harold Banks, who was the special effects guy. There we go. But Old Man Banks had chased him off just before he died. So they, you know, the sheriff is like, okay, where have you been? And he tells me, and he says, yeah, did you run up on anybody? You know, and he's trying to lead him into maybe making some sort of confession. The guy says, yes, I was on Banks's property, and I saw him a few days ago, and no, he didn't fire his gun at me, but he had a gun, and he told me he didn't appreciate me being on his property, and I left because I'm up there looking for specific rocks and some interesting, not necessarily artifacts, but he does established that he has found some interesting artifacts while he was up there, some Indian artifacts and some others that he can't explain. Now, very early on, we see a Jeep drive in with Morris Ankrum and his daughter, Sally Frazier. That's Janet Cleveland and Dr. Frederick Cleveland. And Dr. Cleveland is there because he's an archaeologist, and he's trying to investigate an old legend, an old story of a Spanish conquistador who broke off from the band of conquistadors who were going through this part of California and heading in the mountains looking for gold on his own, a character by the name of Vargas. And he was the giant, you know, big, huge guy. And his nickname was El Giant Diablo. Well, you don't have to know much Spanish to figure out that is the giant devil. And, you know, one of the cool things about these movies back then that made them sort of enjoyable is you always learn stuff of some sort. I learned a little Spanish. Any of these movies that took place in the rural parts of California, there was always a Spanish influence there. And so I always picked up a little Spanish. So I knew that Diablo meant devil from movies like this. And, of course, when Dr. Cleveland tells Brooks this, Brooks says, why did they call him the devil? And he explains how apparently he slaughtered some innocent people and was an evil guy, and all he wanted was gold, and he really didn't care about anything else. Now, you can probably see this one coming a mile away, because this is 1958, and in 1958 movies, whenever you have a young guy and a young girl, they are destined to fall in love, and of course, Brooks wastes no time in putting a move on Sally Fraser's character, Janet, and cutting to the chase, and I'm not going to give you a play-by-play of the entire movie or the story, but they get a date for that evening. Now, you have to suspend a lot of disbelief in some of these movies. People move pretty quickly on this in these movies because this movie, this film is just barely 70 minutes long. And you have to move quickly. So these two, you know, instant attraction. They're going to a double feature in a nearby town. And before all that comes about, Brooks tells Kemmerer that he's found some interesting things. And he would be more than happy to share with him some of the strange rock formations and some of the artifacts that he hasn't covered during his geological survey. And Cleveland says, hey, that's great. That could save me a lot of time because I'm looking for Spanish artifacts and any evidence that this El Giant Diablo exists. Now, we find out throughout the movie, throughout the beginning of this film, from things that Dr. Cleveland says to Brooks, that his contemporaries do not think much of his theory about the giant devil and any of this. And his search and this quest for El Diablo is almost, I want to say, it's very close to being an obsession like Ahab and the giant whale, giant white whale, I should say. You know, a lot of people don't believe him. And this guy, it has been his entire life's work and obsession. And even Janet makes a comment during the beginning of the movie saying, you know, Dad, you know, you ought to give this up. You're going through ridicule and stuff. You haven't found any evidence of this thing. And basically, we understand that this trip up into the mountains in this area is probably going to be the last hurrah for Dr. Cleveland. If he doesn't find anything up there, and if nothing comes about, then that's going to be the end. He's just going to give it up and not do it again. Well, when Cleveland visits Brooks's lab, they discover something sort of interesting. There's a lizard in a box that has been extinct for hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years. And Kemmerer says he was in suspended animation in this rock. And when I broke open this rock, he came too. He says, I think there is something very unusual in the ground, in the rocks, you know, some kind of chemical or something that keeps things in suspended animation, keeps them alive. He says, it's fascinating. He says, you know, this wasn't what I was up there looking for, but it's put an interesting development on the research that I've been doing up here. Now, at the same time, he pulls out the artifacts that he has found that Dr. Cleveland was interested in, and a couple of pieces of things. Cleveland takes a look at it and sees that they form a cross, and they form a Spanish cross. And Cleveland goes, there it is. This was a mixed among Indian artifacts. And, of course, the site where all this was discovered is very near an Indian burial ground. And we find out later in the movie that this is also another controversial thing because one of the local Indians that lives up there is very, very concerned about people routing around in his ancestor's graveyard and digging up the graves, which is just absolute sacrilege to the Native Americans living in this town. Old Joe is the name of the Indian character in this, Indian Joe. Played by a guy named Billy Dix, who didn't have a long career in Hollywood, but he'll be a very recognizable face. And he always played a Native American in just about every movie that I ever saw him appear. But this cross, Cleveland goes, this proves that the Spaniards or some kind of Spanish influence was here. It was up in this area. I'm on the right track. And he says, I would love to see where you found this. And they agree to go up there the next day. So they go up into that area. They load up all of their equipment and head up there, much to the consternation of the sheriff, who has declared that area off limits because of the murders that have happened recently and all of the strange happenings. But Cleveland tells, you know, finally convinces Sheriff Parker that it's okay. he will take full responsibility because the sheriff says, look, Brooks is one of my suspects and I don't want him routing around there and he's supposed to stay in town. You know, the old don't leave town without letting me know. And Cleveland says, I'll be responsible for him. We're going up there to investigate this. This old legend that I've been investigating for years, and the sheriff grudgingly says, yeah, fine. Okay, you can go up there with him. Just watch yourself and be careful. And you know, they establish we've got guns, we'll be okay, and we can take care of ourselves. Now, they're up there for a couple of days. They've got a metal detector looking for artifacts. We have a run-in with Brooks and Indian Joe, who actually, Indian Joe takes a shot at him, and then Brooks says, hey, look, I thought we were friends, and I'm not up here disturbing your ancestors' graves. I promise you, I'm up here looking for these other artifacts, for these Spanish artifacts. And Indian Joe says, yeah, you're my buddy, you're okay. You know, and you've always told me the truth, unlike a lot of the people in town, and that's fine. You know, I'm sorry I shot at you. Didn't mean to, you know, I didn't hit you or whatever, but they go on looking. Now, Cleveland's not having any luck. And after they've been up there for a while, he finally admits to Janet. He says, you know what? I think maybe I ought to give this up. You know, it's obvious there's nothing up here. We've had no luck. We'll just give it all up. And Janet grabs the metal detector and says, hey, look, give me the, while you guys are having your coffee or taking a coffee break, they've been up all night and all day and they don't have much sleep. She says, yeah, you take your break. I'm going to go play with this thing and maybe, who knows? You know, what the heck? And she's rounding around. She gets off of the area that they've been searching around. And this is a heavy, you know, you've seen these metal detectors are pretty heavy. She sits down on this big log, catching her breath when old Wayne comes back around and says, hey, what are you doing? She says, I didn't have any luck at all. And of course, in typical 1958 style, she has pulled out a compact and she's touching up her makeup and her hair. Yeah, come on, lady, you're on a camping trip. It's okay. You know, and they still have, you ever notice in these movies, they have perfectly coiffed hair and makeup, you know, even if they're out roughing it in the wilds. But I always got a kick out of that growing up on some of these movies. You know, these women would wake up from sleeping out on a campsite and just perfectly coiffed hair. But anyway, see, the reason I mention that is when Brooks gets there and says, okay, I guess we're going to pack it up and go on in, and we're going to give this up. And they start walking off. She says, oh, my compact. I must have dropped it over at the log. And he says, I'll go get it. And he runs back over, and he's got the metal detector with him, and he reaches over, sees her compact, and sets the metal detector down. And as he's picking it up, the thing starts going crazy. Now, I don't know why it didn't go crazy while she was sitting there, but it goes crazy then, and he goes, there's something there. And next thing we know, they're digging it up, and they find a helmet, a Spanish, you know, a conquistador helmet, you know, those really cool-looking helmets that we've seen in all of the Spanish conquistador movies. And they realize, this may be it, and they start digging some more, and they find all of this armor and some huge pieces of armor. And Brooks goes, this could be your El Diablo guy. This stuff is big. And they find evidence of the rest of the guys that El Diablo supposedly killed. They find the bones and they find a skull. And of course, this is the one thing about these movies back then that sort of drives me a little nuts is so many of the women in these movies do nothing but just scream. They just really don't do anything. They're there to look pretty and to scream. And I'm afraid, you know, this is where I'll get on Richard Kuna a little bit, the way he directed this. But this is how they made movies back then. Sally Frazier sees the skull, starts screaming, you know, as if, look, I don't think it's going to hurt you. But, you know, and she really doesn't do much of anything in this film but that. Unfortunate. That is one of the weaknesses in that it's a pet peeve. It's a pet peeve. I'd like to see women have a better role in some of these films, a stronger character. But they dig up all of this stuff. Doctor there, Morris Ankrum, and Janet, they go back, and Brooks is just cleaning up out there. And as he's routing around, he finds something else, a big battle axe that is embedded in a large tree, and he tries to get it out, but he can't get out. It's embedded so deeply, he's not strong enough to pull it out. He's very excited, and he heads back, and he tells Dr. Cleve, he says, I found evidence, absolute evidence now, that this has got to be El Diablo. I found his battle axe, and I'll show you the spot in the morning. We'll go up there, and we will check it out, and I'll show you. Maybe I think you're onto something here. Well, a big storm is brewing up, big thunderstorm. And as we look a little closer, as the camera pans in a little tighter on where this axe is, all of a sudden, this is a very nice shot. It's a very, very nice shot. And this one I will give some kudos to Richard Cunha for, because you see some eyes pop open. And it is El Diablo, Buddy Bear, in all of his glory, comes up and walks out of the leaves. And he's all covered in, he'd been all covered up with the mud and the leaves and stuff. And he gets up and he grabs the axe and walks off. Now, this is where you really have to suspend some disbelief. And I'm not talking about the fact that you got a guy who supposedly died 550 years ago, rising from the dead and going off. I mean, that happens in horror films all the time. But the thing that I still to this day don't quite understand and have to attribute to a script writing problem or a logic problem, probably needed a good script girl for this one, is that in the beginning of the movie, all these guys are talking about, well, you got the murder of old man Banks, you've got the cattle that has been slaughtered, and all of the strange stuff that's going on. You've got Wayne Brooks, who finds evidence of something going through up there, branches broken off that he attributes to heavy winds and stuff. But the assumption is that it's this guy, it's El Diablo walking around there doing all this stuff. Yet at this point of the movie, which is almost halfway through the movie, we see him come to life. So I'm still not sure. I don't want to overanalyze this. It's a 77-minute movie at, $54,000 budget. But I have to wonder, did somebody mess up on this? Because we're seeing him come to life about 35-minute mark. But we're hearing about all of this stuff that was going on beforehand, or had he reanimated and covered himself up, by his battle axe or whatever? I don't know. But I just, to have fun with this movie, I figured, don't worry about it. And it is a fun movie. This movie moves very, very quickly. Well, let's, cutting to the chase, El Diablo is on the move, and they find evidence of that. And there's another murder, and the murder, gruesomely happens to Anne Brown, Charlie's sister, gets brutally murdered. Of course, they live up in these cabins, up in the mountains there, and it's sort of isolated. So, a lot of people come up there to stay at the cabins. And she's up there when Charlie is in town, and she meets El Diablo. And this is the first time we see El Diablo in all of his glory. He has gotten his armor back. He's got his battle axe, and we don't see him kill Anne, but we know she gets killed. Yeah, as the camera cuts away, we hear the scream, and we know, and then she is found later, brutally murdered. Well, the sheriff immediately thinks it's got to be Wayne Brooks, because they're still up there. Someone has come into their camp and taken all of the armor. It's all gone. Well, of course, we know it's El Diablo, but they still, at this point, aren't really sure. And, Janet's like, you don't think he came to life and is walking around. And of course, Wayne is like, maybe. And, Dr. Cleveland's like, no, that's impossible. That's not possible. Something else is going on. And he's suspecting that maybe someone might be, playing a game with him. But suffice to say that the sheriff shows up and he immediately puts old Wayne under arrest because he said, we have found the body of Anne Brown. And you're my suspect, and I'm arresting you for the murder of Anne Brown. I'm going to take you back into town. He handcuffs him and starts taking him back. Well, we've got Dr. Cleveland and his daughter are still up there at the campsite because they want to investigate this some more, and they want to find out what's going on. Well, as Sheriff Parker is taking Wayne back to town, he says, look, can we stop by and check on Indian Joe? I think he will corroborate a lot of the things that I have told you about. And I think maybe, he might have stolen some of the artifacts because he's trying to protect the property up there. And the sheriff says, yeah, fine. Okay, we'll check. I'm going to check on him anyway because all of this stuff is going on. And they find him. And Indian Joe is like hung up like a side of beef in his cabin. And Brooks says, I guess that sort of clears me. I mean, you know, obviously I'm not the murderer because look what happened to Indian Joe. And the sheriff's like, yeah, you're right. He says, all right, we got to get into town. We got to get the people motivated, you know, get some of the guys out there. We're going to have to go on a manhunt for this thing and find out what's going on because we've got a murderer on the loose up there. And they head into town and the people are all congregating in town. And they, you know, like they do in all these movies, you know, just short of getting the torches and heading up into the mountains to go get something like you do in all the Frankenstein movies. And sheriff says, like, I'm going to go defuse this. You stay here in the car and I'll be right back. And he goes to talk to the townspeople when all of a sudden Dr. Cleveland drives up. Because what has happened in the meantime, and a lot of this flips back and forth, old El Diablo has gotten Janet. He has knocked out Dr. Cleveland, who comes to and realizes that Janet has been kidnapped by El Diablo. And what has happened is that El Diablo has chased her all throughout the mountains and again, you know, unfortunately, Janet's a screamer and a victim, and El Diablo is after her. And now we've got one of the, sorry, folks, but it's like one of these cliches that does sort of drive me crazy. As Janet is trying to get away from El Diablo, she races for the Jeep that they drove up there. And guess what? As happens in probably 90% of these movies from this time period, the Jeep doesn't start. It's worked fine all the way up throughout this entire movie, but now it won't start. And so she she passes out in the Jeep, and El Diablo, of course, grabs her. You know, he kills everybody else. He even killed Anne Brown, but he grabs her. I you know, this is, again, suspend a little disbelief. Why did he spare her? And, you know, poor Anne. I mean, you know, maybe was she too young for him or what? I don't know. But, you know, poor Anne, she doesn't do very well. So we know he's got Janet. And, of course, Dr. Cleveland wakes up and he realizes what's happened and he tries to start the Jeep and it won't start. But he rolls it down the hill and it's a manual transmission and it starts right off and heads off to town. Now, he's driving. He screeches into town while the sheriff is trying to defuse that situation and tells Wayne, he says, look, it's got Janet. It's got Janet. I've seen him. He does exist in all that. And so what does Wayne do? He says, here, get in the car. They're in the sheriff's car. And he takes off. And he goes, what about the sheriff's car? And he goes, doesn't matter. He'll find us. And obviously, he will. And they go speeding up into the mountains. Car. The sheriff grabs the Jeep the Jeep that would not start now is starting really, really well. And some of the townspeople, and they head up into town looking for him. And they get up there and it's basically shoot to kill. If you see this guy, Brooks, you know, he's our murderer. He must be because he's running away. We're going to find him. Well, Cleveland and Brooks are trying to find Janet and see what has happened to her. And now we've got the search going after Wayne Brooks. We've got Wayne Brooks and Cleveland trying to find Janet. And of course, and I should say in the meantime here, Dr. Cleveland chops the handcuffs, or at least the chain part of the handcuffs, off of them, so at least Wayne's got he's got free hands now. It must have been a heck of a thing trying to drive with the handcuffs on all the way up there. And we see Vargas. Vargas is up there, and Janet is all right, but she's trapped. And as he approaches, Vargas the giant grabs his axe and he's going to go get Wayne. And Janet screams, and this time, just in time for him to avoid being struck, we got a little bit of a fight scene starting, and then the sheriff shows up and he sees the giant and realizes, oh my God, this thing really does exist, and he fires at him and he scares the giant off. Now, I'm not going to say that the giant is bulletproof, but he is wearing armor. So the first few times they shoot him, and of course the sheriff's just shooting him with a revolver, so it probably has like a 38 caliber shell in it. That doesn't really show that they're bouncing off, but they're obviously not doing very much. And the giant goes off. They grab Janet, and the sheriff says, hey, I'm sorry. You were telling the truth. And they grab the other guys and the posse, and they say, okay, no, this is what we're looking for. Very dangerous. Let's be very careful. Here's the area he's in. And to make a long story short, they trap him in a part of the mountains. He's trapped in sort of an alcove in the mountains that he can't get out. Now, for whatever reason I can think of, they want to get more ammunition and more guns, and they've got to head back into town and get supplies and all of this. And this is the part that just slays me. The sheriff finds one guy and he says, hey, you stay up here. Make sure he doesn't get out. You know, it's like, okay, Sheriff, you know, you really think that's a smart move? Well, it wasn't, because the guy that is left to guard the giant gets killed. They find him dead later on, and Vargas is back out on the loose. But what we've got here, also is another little side story going. Charlie Brown, the young kid, you know, he wants to help, and he feels very guilty about the fact that his sister got killed by this thing, and he blames himself because he left her by herself, and then she gets killed. And, of course, he's been carrying with that around with him. Well, the sheriff, you know, has him running errands. He's sort of the errand boy right now. He doesn't want, and he did it to protect him. He doesn't want him to get hurt, but Charlie, instead of going back into town to get some food for them or whatever, grabs a rifle and figures, I'm going to go out on my own while they're all asleep and resting up for the night, waiting for the rest of the supplies come up. I'm going to go up there and take them on myself. And, of course, Charlie does, and he finds, and he's the one, actually, that finds Bill, the guy that was left up there dead. And he sees Vargas, and he fires at him, and then we cut back to the camp. And the sheriff is wondering, where is Charlie Brown? Yeah, here we go. Where is Charlie Brown? And Wayne says, wait a minute, he couldn't have gone up in there. And he goes up in there, and they find, Wayne finds Charlie Brown all beat up, and obviously, and he dies on them. He tells him where the giant headed to. And he ends up going up into this, a small cabin, up into the mountains, another small cabin, and he confronts the giant in the cabin, and it does not go well. He tries hitting him with the gun. He tries hitting him with a big stick, tries all sorts of things, and nothing's working. And, of course, the other guys are headed up that way, and they see him. And during this fight sequence, which lasts, you know, and I got to tell you, folks, again, this is the one thing about the movie that is so typical of 1958 movies. All the action happens in about the last 12 minutes of this film. I mean, it's all happening at this point, but that's the way they work. But it's still, this film has moved pretty quickly along the way. So I'm not going to say this was a boring movie and then it all started happening. But a lot happens in this last 10 minutes, which is why I'm just sort of going to skirt through it. Old Vargas and Wayne are going at it, and it leads out to this big walking bridge that goes across a beautiful waterfall up there, and they're fighting up on the bridge. And during the fight, Vargas has got he's got the battle axe, and he goes, makes a swing at Wayne, and Wayne ducks strategically. Vargas loses his balance and crashes through the gate rail on the bridge and goes falling down the waterfall, which looks like thousands and thousands of feet down there, obviously to his death. Now, one of the few goofs in this movie, other than the fact that I pointed out, I'm not sure about, you know, when they resurrected Vargas in this thing and the earlier murders and things, you know, be that as it may on that, Vargas, when he goes, when we see the close-up scene of he and Wayne fighting on the bridge, and he goes crashing through the handrail, obviously that's on a set. And then we cut back to the actual bridge. There was parts of the shot on the actual bridge in this beautiful area, because the guardrail clearly smashes loose as he goes crashing through it. But then when we cut to the long shot, it's okay. The guardrail's back. But what the heck? We're right at the very end of the movie, so I'm going to give him that one. And we find out from the sheriff, as you know, when Dr. Cleveland says, Sheriff, will you help me go find the body? I want to go down to where this thing, to this crater lake that that this river flows into, and find the body. And the sheriff says, we've never been able to find the bottom of it. I mean, it's so deep that no one has ever been to the bottom. I'm afraid your conquistador is gone forever. And that is the end of the movie. And of course, how do we close this movie? Can you guess? Well, of course, we close with Wayne and Janet in an embrace, kissing, and obviously this is going to be a relationship that is going to live happily ever after. Giant from the Unknown. Again, folks, it's not the best movie in the world. It's entertaining. I could say you could have a Mystery Science Theater type evening with some friends if you wanted to, but I still pay this movie some respects. I mean, it's still a lot of fun. It's a decent story. And again, you have to suspend a little disbelief, but it would be fun to have a bunch of people over with a lot of popcorn and stuff. And, you know, with lines like, where is Charlie Brown? And some of the fun you could have with this, but, fun, not in a cruel way, but fun in a respectful way. I think in many ways, this movie is a little better than the one I mentioned earlier that people confuse it for, the thing that couldn't die. That one is a little nuts. And actually, that one got a little more playtime on the Monster Movie matinee rotation than this one did. But this one, I think, is just a lot more fun to watch. And maybe it's because a lot of the actors that are in it are more familiar to me, and I've seen them in more films. So I would say, you know, just for novelty's sake, check out Giant from the Unknown. There's a lot of copies of it out there. I think you can even see it on YouTube. It's amazing how many of these old films are up on YouTube, but I will warn you, some of those, the quality of the films are not very good because people are either uploading like a VHS copy and the translation doesn't do very well digitally. There's a lot of free movie services out there like 123 Movies, and of course you might check Netflix and others, because so many of these have been restored. I don't know if this one has been restored, but I know you can probably find a pretty good copy of it out there. And it's worth a look. So I'll give it, how about a half a thumbs up? But it's fun. It's fun, and I'm not going to call it a bad movie, but, you know, it's one you take with a grain of salt, you put on the 1958 filter, get a lot of popcorn, munch on it, have a good time, and enjoy Giant from the Unknown. Well, next week, folks, we've got another one for you, and we're going to also take a look at another actor who was a very, very popular actor for me as a kid growing up, and someone that we mentioned at great length in an earlier podcast. Think back to House of Frankenstein and a particular character actor with a booming voice in that, and you're going to know who I'm talking about. And this, the film next week is going to definitely fall into my category of guilty pleasures. And I say that lovingly. A lot of folks didn't understand that expression when I first used it, but I say that these are films that I love to watch over and over again. I really don't feel guilty about it, but it's just a great expression, guilty pleasures. Next week's movie, a true guilty pleasure, and hopefully you'll have as much fun with it as I am going to have talking about it with you. Also, folks, I want to remind you of our sponsor here on Monster Attack, and if you like what we do here every week, please be sure to check them out. That's Subculture Corsets and Clothing.com, or if you are listening to us down in the Jacksonville, Florida area, they have a physical store down there in Jacksonville, Florida. Just go ahead and look them up online at subculturecorsetsandclothing.com. And also, folks, be sure to visit our website from time to time, our Project Entertainment Network website. We are a proud member of that network, and we hope that you will visit our Patreon page, because it's a way that you can personally become involved with some of the great programming we have here on Project Entertainment Network, and maybe you would like to become a patron of Monster Attack. We would love that, but I'll tell you what, as long as we're having fun with this, we're going to keep it coming to you every Monday at 5 o'clock, and we thank you for your continued support. The numbers have been absolutely terrific this year going into our second season, and we thank you so much. And we hope you have a good time with Monster Attack every week, and be sure to pass on to your friends and neighbors that we do a new episode every Monday at 5 o'clock. Folks, take care, and we'll see you next week.
Watch out. There's a new terror taking over kitchens around the world. Thrills, chills, mad cooking skills.
It Cooks, a weekly podcast brimming with recipes, tips, food finds, seasonal specials, and guests galore. Hosted by horror author Amber Fallon. Hey, that's me. A foodie with over 20 years experience cooking, baking, and generally making a nuisance of herself. You've watched Food Network, you've read cookbooks, but nothing can prepare you for It Cooks, coming to a device near you.
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.